That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host. This is part two of my two-part interview with my writing partner, David Isaacs. David currently is a tenured professor at USC, and they have a pretty good film school over there. And we get into a lot of comedy theory. If you caught last week's, we talked a lot about romantic comedy and the theory of comedy and that sort of thing. If you didn't hear last week's show, after you listen to this, go back and hear that one. This time we continue. We talk about buddy comedies. We talk a lot more about television comedy. So if you're interested in comedy at all, this is the show for you. Part two, my interview with my writing partner, David Isaacs, this week on Hollywood and Levine. Another popular genre is buddy comedies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, why are buddy comedies so successful, and what are a couple of examples of good buddy comedies?
Well, some of the best. Well, but the nice thing about buddy comedies is you can kind of they can go across all kinds of genres. Maybe the greatest buddy comedy of all time, and although you wouldn't necessarily call it a comedy first, but you would call it a Western first. But it was, in a sense, a kind of buddy picture comedy. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Okay.
One of the great ones.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly The Odd Couple, which is a form in itself, the two opposites living together. I've got to say, Chuck Lorre has made a very successful career out of just doing variations of The Odd Couple. Two and a Half Men,
mm-hmm.
Mike and Molly, his new one. Even The Kaminsky Method is another version of The Odd Couple.
That's right. I was reading a book about Mike Nichols, and he was talking about The Odd Couple. Mike Nichols directed the original Broadway version of The Odd Couple written by Neil Simon. And Neil Simon described The Odd Couple, and I never heard it described this way, but when you think about it, you go, sure. And, you know, Neil Simon kind of knows the subject matter. He said, The Odd Couple is about two men who get divorced, who live together, and wind up having the same arguments they had when they were married.
Yes, that's exactly what it is.
Uh-huh.
That's a sort of great guiding line
to
writing the play, or I'm even writing the series. That's all you really have to hang it on. The funny thing is now, if you did that show now, there'd always be two guys that age living together. There would be the gay, you know, question hanging over the thing, which is funny, which could lead you to something else. Wait a minute, there could be another play there. You need a kind of one guy's got to sort of drive. One guy's got to usually be the brains of the outfit. The other guy is the guy who sort of follows along religiously with the other guy, Laurel and Hardy.
I mean, they're friends, but oftentimes they're rivals.
Yeah.
I mean, I go way back to the Hope Crosby movies.
Absolutely.
You know, where these two guys were best friends, but they were always scamming each other.
Well, they were scamming each other, and Bing was sort of the brains, and Bob was the kind of, well, he was the comic relief within the comic team. Another one I really have always enjoyed is Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yeah.
With John Candy and Steve Martin, who were a great comic pairing. They probably would have done more films together had they had the time and Candy had lived longer. Midnight Run is a great, even though it's a crime, it's a cop picture in a way.
Right.
But it's a great buddy comedy.
Right.
In a sense.
Charles Grodin and Robert De Niro, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think those kind will continue to, they continue to make them. I mean, Bad Boys is another version of it. Nice Guys was out like a year ago with Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling. You know, it's a good standard kind of, you know, the sort of family car, if you will. They keep making them, you know, and it's just it's interesting pairings, I think, is what you're looking for.
You talk about comedy being dark, and it seems to me that is more in fashion these days. When you look at TV comedies, most of the shows that are considered comedies, like Fleabag and Barry, and some of these shows that are very well-respected and winning awards, are not the comedies that you're used to, where the goal was to make people laugh. I guess that's just kind of where we are as a society
today.
Well,
I have a little bit of a theory about it, although it's probably thin. But you mentioned Fleabag, which I like very much. And there's some other things I enjoyed. For a while, I enjoyed the Judd Apatow's series that he produced called Love, which was set in L.A., was on Netflix. Catastrophe is another one I thought was pretty good, you know, which is a romantic comedy. It's very dark. And I think maybe what it is our capacity for watching a human being destroy themselves or make choices that are so bad and so self-destructive is greater than it used to be. It's a simple
way. I would agree
with you. It's a simple way of putting it. I watch Fleabag. I'm laughing. First of all, I think she's an amazing writer. And she can make a whole half hour about six people sitting around a dining room table with very interesting characters and have you laughing to the point where, you know, at the end she gets punched out by her brother-in-law after she punches him out. And everyone's bleeding, and that's the end of the show. And I have to believe that 20 or 30 years ago, you would not want to watch a woman with a kind of self-destructive vein that way go through these kind of escapades. And now it seems like we have a greater tolerance for it, and we'll laugh at the truth of it, but we're not turned off by that level of self-destructiveness.
So we're more callous in a way,
sort of, or
in a way more cruel.
Well,
I mean, I look at The Office
more aware in a way as well.
Okay,
more willing to admit that people are flawed in a sense. We don't necessarily need to land on the ideal.
Okay,
you know,
I look at The Office,
yeah,
and the conceit is that this is a documentary they are making. And a lot of the humor comes from the characters finding themselves in humiliating situations that they know are being filmed and are being seen publicly. And so the humor comes from the fact that you're watching them humiliate themselves. And it's funny, but there's also kind of a lack of humanity a little bit to that, don't you think?
I don't know if I would agree that way. If you think about it, the setting itself is not what you would ideally pitch from our time in the business.
These are worker drones.
This is
people
soul-sucking, environment,
right?
Which is a dead end environment,
right?
The only person you think has a chance of getting out of there is Jim,
mm-hmm.
because he seems to be. Well, Dwight is a psychopath, and the other people are sort of holding on. They need the jobs, but they're not happy. They're led by a self-deluding, you know, not too particularly bright, well-meaning, but not what you'd call a great leader.
Right.
And yet we're laughing because we identify, I think, with the feeling of being trapped, in a sense, in the place we work or the place we live. Mm-hmm. I would going back to romantic comedy, you mentioned it before, I think the Jim and Pam romance is the best television romance since the one that feels the most real and even more real than since Sam and Diane. I really always thought that was so real and so identifiable, you know, the way that romance starts, the way it goes. And there's a bit
more
of
so than Rachel and Ross and Friends?
More so for me, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Rachel, that was, believe me, I just identified with Ross because and I just was watching that going, come on, buddy, you can do it. She was so incredibly sexy. But this felt real. This felt like you lived in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're both fans of the show but yeah, I mean, I don't think The Office could have been... could have worked 25 years ago, you know. It was right for the time, and Greg Daniels did just a great job of kind of taking the Brit, because we're not very good at, with the exception of a couple of instances, we're not very good at adapting British shows to American television.
No, you look at Coupling,
and he just did a great job of making it decidedly American. You know, Scranton, Pennsylvania, Dunder Mifflin Paper Company, the attitudes, everything felt like very real and very, very funny. And I think that's why that show just will hold up for many, many years, if not forever.
And by the way, going back to Coupling, which is one of my all-time favorite shows.
The British version
done by Stephen Moffat. Mm-hmm. And they tried a U.S. version. And the problem with the U.S. version was the network, was NBC. And NBC managed to take everything good about Coupling and change it and make it glossy and pretty people and just completely miss the point. So there's a case where a network came in and absolutely killed a show.
Well, it was dead on arrival because it's a show about sex and unashamedly about sex. And American television in those days, network television certainly, and probably still is very prurient about sex. It's almost like we sort of like hold our hand up to our mouth and giggle about it as opposed to like dealing with it or talking about it, because there's this sort of this strain of Puritanism. I don't know, whatever. But
well, that's network, and I think it's one of the reasons why young people don't identify with network sitcoms,
exactly,
because they look at that and they go, "This is junior high."
Exactly.
Yeah,
it doesn't feel the least bit real, and certainly in the multicam sense, that just doesn't fly.
Let's take a moment and talk about Friends, because mm-hmm. that I contend the three most popular sitcoms in history, when you look at syndication and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. and you know, longevity,
mm-hmm.
I Love Lucy, mm-hmm. MASH, and Friends.
I wouldn't argue. I don't think there's anything else I would throw in there.
Yeah. Why is Friends... I'm throwing you a softball here.
Yeah.
Why is Friends so popular?
Well, first of all, the casting is... They hit it out of the park.
Uh-huh.
I call it the most watchable show in the history of television. The other thing is in its youthfulness... It's perennially youthful because of the very nature of the subject matter. It's a time most of us would identify with, in that time when we leave our homes, or we leave college at least, and we go out into the world, And before we make our own family, we live in this kind of our 20s mostly. I'm saying this, I'm sort of overgeneralizing this, but I think we all identify with that time of romance and first romances and real profound romances for the first time. And the family that you form with your friends, it's just a great, it's there for you.
And
you
it was know? Beautifully written. It was really funny.
Knockout, always well written.
There were always good three jokes, stories always that all dovetailed.
Absolutely.
And, yeah.
But I think that's why every generation, I know my daughters are that age now, and they love that show. They've mm-hmm. loved it since their teens. But they really love it because I think they completely, it's idealized. It's like way, it's the way you see your life. And as I was saying before, it's what you identify with. You laugh at it because I have friends like that. Mm-hmm. I know those people. I have a friend like Phoebe, you know, who's a bit addled and a little bit off. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just reflects back and forth and back and forth and to infinity in terms of identifiability and irony. And it's fueled to last forever.
And ironically, it is also a multi-camera show shot in front of a live studio audience. And so many people are saying, well, that's dead. That's all such a retro form. And yet, when you look at Friends, it is as retro as can possibly be. And there is another sitcom that my daughter and her husband watch all the time, and tons of people watch, and I know because I hosted an evening about this show at USC a few years ago, Golden Girls.
Yes.
Okay. Now here's a show if you say, I want to attract the millennial audience. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to have a show about 50-year-old and 60-year-old women who live together in Miami. And that's going to be the show that they watch. And yet they do. Why?
Well, start again with you get four very funny ladies.
Mm-hmm.
Four masters of stage comedy. All very distinct characters. And once again, it's about friendship. It's about the identity. It's about specifically the problems of people in the AARP age range,
mm-hmm.
but they still have the same sort of they still come up with the same kinds of romantic dilemmas. Their devotion to each other is in the ideal. You kind of still identify even. And it's funny. It's just brilliantly written.
It is just loaded with jokes.
Yeah.
Just lathered on with jokes. Yeah.
And you know, you go there because you know you're going to laugh. I mean, that's the simple answer to the question. But I think it always comes down to relatability. I mean, we also have, if you're young, you have parents. You have grandparents. You know, they live down in Florida. They act in a way that these women kind of act with each other, and so you just identify with that kind of sense of family, sense of interaction.
Okay, final question.
Mm-hmm.
You teach at USC.
Yes.
What are the types of comedies?
You're not going to ask me what's happening with Felicity Huffman.
No, I'm not going to ask you. I'm going to ask you about Laura Loughlin.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Well, she made a big mistake.
No, I'm going to ask you, what are the types of comedy that your students want to write today?
I would say that on the high end, they want to write things like Fleabag. The women certainly do.
Mm-hmm.
They want to write across a diverse landscape. Atlanta is a very popular show for very good reasons.
Okay.
Animation is a form in itself. Half hour. If you want to say in a way that where's the sitcom go, it's gone to animation. Shows like Rick and Morty, BoJack Horseman, mm-hmm. those are the shows they love. Those are the shows they want to write. So in a sense, live action is not their first choice.
Mm-hmm.
Just right now, I would say on network, I don't think there's anything. I mean,
they don't want to write Mom, do
no,
they?
No, that doesn't come up much. I mean, and I like Mom. I think it's a great show.
They don't want to write Carol's Second Chance
no.
or whatever the hell that show is.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God, Carol.
They don't want to write Last Man Standing,
do
they?
I don't think Carol's got any chance.
Uh-huh. Did they watch Will and Grace when Will and Grace came back?
Yeah, they did.
Okay.
They are not Murphy Brown, but Will and Grace. Modern Family, of course, was there, but it's kind of run its course. They're not as they're going to tend to want to write things that are a little darker, just in general.
Mm-hmm.
Blackish, grownish, you know, those kind of shows, and that of course that it plays along the lines of ethnicity and diversity. You're going to tend to want to write from your community and your neighborhood, in a sense. So it's a more right away. It's a more diverse landscape. There's just there's nothing you can kind of put all into one basket. They're for them, Orange is the New Black is as much a comedy for them as Mom is, or you know,
mm-hmm.
Or as Fleabag is, I suppose. You
right.
know? So it doesn't have to just be packaged into a half hour. Those are the kind of things that pop up. There's stuff that's out in the, what I would call out in the weeds. There's a show on, now that the Tina Fey shows have sort of phased out. I mean, The Good Place is another popular show.
Mm-hmm.
But out in the weeds, I would say there's a show on Comedy Central called The Others, which is written by some writers from Saturday Night Live, which is about a young child star and his brother, and it centers on his brother and sisters. His brother and sister, who are kind of this ne'er-do-well, jealous couple.
It's a good idea, actually.
Yeah,
it's a really good idea.
And it's in the vein of Kimmy Schmidt or what I call the theater of absurdity more mm-hmm. than what I would call sitcom.
I mean, those are live cartoons, really.
Yeah. Well, it's absurd. I would call it absurdity,
mm-hmm.
which is what I called what I would call the Tina Fey shows, which I love. I love 30 Rock, and not as much Kimmy Schmidt, but still very funny, and they tend to be more absurd than they are
right.
sitcoms. But mm-hmm. but you know, nobody can write like her. So those are the ones right now.
Okay, David, thank you very much.
My
this
pleasure.
This has been fun.
It's been great. I've only been away from class about 3 days, and I missed it oh so much.
David Isaacs, ladies and
Thank
gentlemen.
Thank you, Kenny.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, no parting gifts. And that will do it for this week of Hollywood and Levine. Again, my thanks to my writing partner, David Isaacs. Also, thanks to Adam and Susie Meister, Butler, John Wolfert, Howard Hoffman, Bruce and Jason Miller. And if you want to get in touch with me, I do write you back. My email address is HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. That is HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. I'm on Twitter at Ken Levine, should you wish to follow me. I'm also on Instagram, Hollywood and Levine. I would always love a 5-star review and maybe a review in iTunes. Anyway, got more good stuff next week. Thanks so much for listening. We will talk to you then. Bye-bye.
Hollywood and Levine.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. Auto Trader.